Hello and welcome to The Past and Stuff with Ashley Bozian and Tracy Cooper. So, Ashley, have you noticed any stuff in the news?
In fact, I have noticed many things in the news of great import. Would you like to start with your stuff in the news or with mine?
Let's do yours.
All right. So one of the interesting things I've noticed in the news, not from an archaeological standpoint, but certainly something of great historical import, is Turkey, or as they're now called, Turkey, has just selected their first female governor of central banking. So that's quite interesting.
Yeah. So let's hand the coin purse over, as it was.
So
Turkey's not had many high-ranking female officials before.
No, they haven't.
Okay, that's certainly. I have three things in the news because I was being greedy. And as I was reading these from the archaeological headlines from archaeology.org, compiled by Jessica E. Saraceni, I was looking at what they had, and there was three that I thought were quite interconnected. So I'm going to share those three. And the first is from Alicante in Spain, where drones have been used to discover rock art. And rock art that's probably about 7,000 years old. But in such rugged areas and such remote and inaccessible caves that the geologist involved, who is an authorized drone pilot, flew his drone into the caves. This is a man called Francisco Javier Molina. And he discovered, explored about 18 caves with his drones and found prehistoric rock art in two of them. So I thought that was really interesting that this is the first time that drones have been deployed to discover cave paintings. It's a really novel way to do this. And if you think about the amount of resources and, human effort involved in reaching these remote places, it means that a lot of money can be saved, having to apply for access and things like that, it's can save time with permits. One of the things I was thinking about is, why people would 7,000 years ago put rock art in such a remote place, such a remote cave that nowadays somebody has to take a drone in there. And the experts that were working on it said that even at the time the artists might have had to build scaffolding to be able to get up to the caves. So when you think about art and what it's for, making it in such a sort of remote and inaccessible place means, the audience is somewhat different. It's not like, hey, everybody, look at this great, great picture of a bison I just drew.
it's limited.
Whoever you're painting it for is quite different. And so the second example I got was not of rock art, but of petroglyphs, which are carved into the art. And these were found on a remote steep rock in Sweden's west coast, a place called Bohuslän. These rocks are so steep that it wouldn't have been possible to kind of stand on them and carve. And at the time of their carving, about 2,500 years ago, they would have been an island. So somebody would have had to either stand in a boat and carve them or wait until it was winter and build a scaffold up on ice and carve them. So a similar kind, long distance in time, but a similar kind of, well, that's a lot of effort to get that carving there. And they're very interesting carvings of people, ships and animals, but also of horses being ridden and of chariots as well. And then my last piece of stuff in the news is regarding the famous NASCAR lines, geoglyphs in Peru. I don't know if you've heard of those massive amount of in size, and an area of about 19 square miles, and so many straight lines in there that it's about 800 miles of lines in total. But probably most famous for the depictions of plants and animals, which are so big you can only really make them out from the air. And so drones have been used there before to capture, you know, to look at the spiders and the plants and stuff. But the new news that's going on from there is that Japan's Yamagata University has used artificial intelligence to analyze pictures captured by drones of the area, and the artificial intelligence has been able to find four new Nazca geoglyphs, which is pretty scary that the, you know, humans had looked at these pictures and missed them. So they've got new geoglyphs of a humanoid, a pair of legs, a big fish, possibly a whale, and a bird. So I think these three stories go together in sort of, you know, ideas of who's supposed to see this stuff and what does it mean, and, you know, the ways that we get to see it today, you know, and discover it, two of which have taken new technology, and one of which the ones on in Sweden on that big rock involved good old-fashioned humans spotting lines that looked like they were just, you know, man-made, and then removing all the moss from the stones. So, you know, technology can do so much, but it can't do everything. That was wrapped up my stories. Okay, Ashley, show me your piece of stuff for this week.
All right, this is my piece of stuff for the week. Let's see if you can guess what it is. I hope you can. I hope most people can.
It's a bar of soap.
It's a bar of soap.
Okay. Not what I was expecting. Is it an old bar of soap? Is it historic?
Thankfully not.
Okay.
Thankfully not.
So the what, when, and where of that particular bar of soap, I have no idea on. The what, when, and where of making soap, I guess. My impression is you boil pig fat and it smells, and then you put other stuff in it like lye and some herbs and shit.
Pretty much.
I'd imagine people have been doing it for, I don't know, I'd say since the time of the ancient Persians. They seem like a soapy kind of people.
About that. Well, but soap making actually has a really long and interesting history, and I like things that are clean and that produce cleanliness. I guess that's just my culture, I don't know, but it is a really interesting history, and I thought it was worth talking about. So the earliest evidence of soap making comes from the 3rd millennium BCE in Mesopotamia, Iranian plateau, Babylon, kind of around there. And then we see it kind of progress along the way into the Islamic world, where it makes its way into Europe, although there's also evidence of independent soap making in Europe in the Roman Empire. Pliny the Elder wrote about soap making being introduced to the Romans by the Gauls. Mm-hmm. So sort of like simultaneous popping up of soap making industries. As for pig fat is one of the things that you could use to make soap. So there are animal fat soaps and vegetable fat soaps, which are more common in the Middle East and the ancient world.
Yeah, there's certain cultures where pig fat might not be the thing.
Yeah, but they also used beef tallow.
Okay.
Which is made from hooves. So that was okay. In certain places more than others. Because we do see soap making in India too. Mm-hmm. Just a really interesting history. Like, where was soap produced with animal fat? Where was it produced with vegetable fat? So the top fats we see being used for kind of vegetarian soaps or vegan soaps, which I guess they wouldn't have called them back then, olive oil, coconut, palm oil, things like that. And What's really interesting is that a large soap making industry flourished, in particular in what's now the city of Aleppo, has for a long time been the city of Aleppo in modern day Syria, where they would add laurel oil to their soap for fragrance, and that became known as Aleppo soap, which is pretty much the only difference between that and what we call Castile soap, which they're both olive oil based soaps. Castile soap lacks the laurel oil that Aleppo soap contains. So all these kind of variations and variations in fragrance. So a common fragrance additive in Europe and in the Middle East became lavender oil, lavender petals. And even in certain places, they would add abrasive things like pumice in volcanic areas to aid in the mechanical action of soap, whether that was exfoliating the skin or adding more mechanized washing potential if they were using it on things like fibers.
And is how long has the soap been sort of produced in a bar? Do you know that? Was it was soap liquid or was it always solid?
It was always solid. So the earliest form of soap was solid. And from my research, a lot of this comes from kind of basic sources like Britannica, basic but reliable sources like Britannica. And then I tried to venture into some of the more chemical indices that were completely, I couldn't understand any of them. But it has to do a lot with the alkaline solution used. So I believe sodium hydroxide is the alkaline preferable for bar soaps, which is what soap was for the vast majority of its history, has been for the majority of its history. And then I believe it was potassium hydroxide that lends itself better to making liquid soaps because it softens the formula.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, liquid soap was more of a modern invention.
And what was it, a female profession, soap making?
It was, yeah.
It's got that cooking kind of brewing sort of quality to it.
Just like witchcraft.
Just like witchcraft, yes. And and was it a household thing? Did every sort of household make their own soap, or did they, was there soap making as a specific by industry of particular women, and then they had an industry selling it?
It didn't emerge, as far as my reading went, and as a household industry until probably the 18th 19th centuries in the Ottoman Empire. It originally started out as kind of a large-scale thing. They would do it in these large copper cauldrons or copper kettles, and they would mass produce it, kind of. And actually in Europe in the 8th and 9th centuries, actually it was earlier than that, about the 5th 6th centuries, I think, there appeared soap making guilds. So it really was professionalized pretty early on.
I mean, think about it, it uses sort of leftover meat product, the meat based ones anyway, it doesn't actually work as a household industry because you wouldn't really get enough to warrant making a whole batch of soap with your four hooves or whatever you had. But in an area where they do tanning and butchery, then it's a sort of an allied industry to that, maybe.
That's a great point. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
What's your favorite soap?
My favorite soap? Oh my gosh, how much time do you have? I love all soap that gets me clean. What's my favorite soap? Trader Joe's makes a nice one. Mass produced, but I can get it easily, and it's always been enjoyable to use. Nice lather, nice fragrance, gets me clean. I don't like glycerin soap very much, which has actually been a byproduct of traditional soap making. They would actually remove the glycerin because they thought it was kind of an inferior product, and I agree, because it doesn't quite cleanse as well as the more alkaline part of the soap. But people with dry skin prefer glycerin soap generally because of that property it has. But initially in the soap making process, the glycerin part, most of it, was removed because it was seen as kind of a waste product.
I do like soaps. Sort of like it's an expensive treat that lasts a long time, I think.
It does last a long time, and it's quick to use too.
It's like a daily pick-me-up treat, a nice soap. All right, well, thanks for that, Ashley. Do you want to hear about my piece of stuff?
I would love to. All right, so what I see is a figurine. Looks to be made of ivory or enamel. I would guess some kind of animal bone product. And she's dressed in robes, wearing a crown, wearing bracelets. So clearly a royal or a rich. Yeah, a royal. She's wearing a crown. Carrying a horn of some kind. And looks shocked and sad. So she's just received some bad news. She's, yeah. So figurine of a sad musical queen. That's my guess.
Okay, it's pretty good. Pretty good. Thanks. Pretty good guess. Any idea of when or where she might be stylistically?
That's a good question. It doesn't look like any of the Byzantine or Near Eastern faces I've seen. The face is distinct. So not from that region, I wouldn't say. So I would guess from Europe somewhere. As for when, that's a good question. Whenever they used ivory, which was always up until very recently. let's see if I can get any clues from the robe or the crown or the little horn thing.
Who drank out of horns?
So someone who drinks. So, Europe, definitely. I can't tell if I'm seeing crosses in the garments or my eyes are just playing tricks on me. Yeah,
crosses would be possible.
I mean, I guess I'd say 13th century just based on what the clothing is depicting, but I'm not really any kind of sartorial expert, so I literally just made that up.
Okay, cool. You're very close. Very close in all your guesses here. This is actually a chess piece, a queen from a chess piece, carved.
She's a queen, okay.
Carved of walrus ivory.
Ooh, okay.
Walrus ivory, and from the 12th to 13th century. So you were close there, probably okay. Around 1150 to 1200. And probably made, according to some experts, in Trondheim in Norway, so in the Viking world here. Although others, and that's based on similarities to other carvings from Trondheim, although other people, interestingly, swear very vehemently that she was carved in Iceland. And one new book called Ivory Vikings that actually names the woman who the author Nancy Brown thinks carved her as Margaret the Adwat, who worked for the Bishop of Iceland. So anyway, she was found on a beach and buried in a sand dune on the Isle of Lewis in Scotland in the Outer Hebrides. So these are known as the Lewis chessmen.
Okay.
And are quite famous. I have one of these as a fridge magnet on my fridge. So a beach called Uig, if I'm pronouncing that right, U-I-G, Uig, on the Isle of Lewis in Scotland. So she was part of a hoard. So there were 93 pieces found in total from probably around five chess sets. So there were several other queens, eight in total, that were found in this hoard. And she is certainly richly dressed, as you commented, and is holding a drinking horn. And this expression is typical of the Lewis chessmen, these sort of overwrought expressions, which we find quite comical, I think, today. She looks sort of, I think you said she had some bad news, she looks worried, she looks shocked, she has a toothache. But all eight of the queen pieces have this same expression with the hand up to the face like this. And experts think it's probably not meant to be comical, but just a little bit over-exaggerated expression of a pensive, thoughtful, plotting, politically adept queen. Sort of, you can almost watch her sort of meta, that would be her expression as she was playing chess on the chess piece, but also playing chess on the wider geopolitical scene that was the Northern world at the time. So we might take as an example somebody like Ord the Deep-Minded, which, you know, this is not necessarily a picture of Ord the Deep-Minded, but of somebody of that type. And she was an interesting character who was born in Norway, the daughter of the awesomely named Kettle Flatnose, who obviously had a flat nose. And she and her father fled Norway when Harald Fairhair united Norway. So, you know, he took over and lots of other aristocrats had to leave if they didn't like being under his rule. Anyway, she went to Ireland. She married the Viking King of Dublin and had children with him. When he died, she went with her son Thorstein to the Hebrides, where the Lewis chessmen were found, and Thorstein became the king of the Hebrides and made a carved a kingdom out in Scotland. When her son died, she was in Caithness in Scotland, and she had a boat made secretly there. And then this boat, she took the boat with 20 crew on board and some male slaves, and went to Iceland and set up a colony in Iceland, freed the male slaves. They became freedmen, which was sort of classed somewhere between slaves and freeborn men. And established a colony in Iceland, and is credited with bringing Christianity to Iceland because Ord the Deep-Minded was a Christian. She has a fabulous story, but is all involved in all the places that are mentioned in the history of the Lewis chessmen, the Hebrides, Ireland, Iceland, and Norway. The walrus ivory itself comes from Greenland. Four of the chess pieces were made of sperm whale teeth. Whatever could pass for ivory in that area. So very much this chess piece talks about the trade networks and probably the networks of prestigious gift giving rather than, making things for sale, but making things for diplomatic context in that North Sea world. But the history of chess itself begins in India. We were just talking about that part of the world with your piece of soap. And it begins in India in the 6th century, and from there spreads in various guises, different parts of the world, including Persia, and then from there with two spreads into Europe, well, probably through Muslim Spain, but perhaps up north to the Viking areas through Viking contacts with Byzantium. So, you have this sort of very much world history attached to chess. And one of the interesting things about the original chess is that it didn't have a queen, but it had an advisor. And the advisor piece couldn't move very far. It could only move one piece one way diagonally. So it wasn't anywhere near as powerful as the modern queen. But in the course of, the chess set becoming Europeanized, the piece developed into the queen. But then under Isabel of Castile, you know, Isabel 1492, sending Columbus out, that Isabel expelling the Jews, that one, the Queen Peace gets the powers that she has now with the extensive, you know, being able to move in any direction and being the most important piece on the board, really, apart from the king, you know, which doesn't move very far, but is the piece that can get taken. So, yeah, chess very, very much sort of bound up in a lots of interesting bits of history. And I think that lastly, the thing I'd say about the Lewis chessmen is, you know, they are part of the heritage of the Outer Hebrides. Very much beloved, very much sort of a symbol for that area to congregate around. The chessmen are, there's nine or 11, I think, in Edinburgh, in the National Museum of Scotland, and the rest are in the British Museum. Now there's been sort of moves by Scotland to reclaim the Lewis chessmen from the British Museum, which have been resisted because the British Museum paid for them back in the 1830s when they were discovered. And, you know, I think the little Isle of Lewis realizes that it can, you know, really possibly pay for the protection of these pieces. And, you know, there's people in the British Museum said if we were going to repatriate them anywhere, we'd give them back to Norway, probably, which is probably where they came from before they were buried on that beach in Lewis. But as I said, there's an interesting new book by Nancy Brown called Ivory Vikings, where she writes a micro history about the Lewis chessmen and really goes, sort of delves into the North Sea world, but makes a rather strong case, I think, that they were made by a woman called Margaret the Adwat, who was working for the Bishop of Iceland, which is indeed possible. I'm not 100% on Nancy Brown's side. I'm probably more like want to be 90% because I think it's a great story, and I think recognizing that objects in the past could equally have been made by women, but we always assume that they've been made by men, is a very good tale. But I think the book is worth reading, and I think the idea that these could have come from Iceland, given that the idea that they didn't come from Iceland is basically Norwegian male professors saying, well, Iceland was a bit grubby at that time and couldn't have possibly have produced something like this. But given the artistic similarities between Iceland and Norway, I'm not exactly sure you can 100% say one place or the other. And I do like the story of a woman called Margaret the Adwat carving these lovely chess pieces.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting piece. Yeah, I have so many questions. I had never really looked that much into the history of chess, which I think is probably embarrassing for me as an Armenian, because Armenia has like this huge chess culture. They've produced a number of grand champions or whatever they're called. I should know that. But it's a big thing for us, for Armenians. But I myself was never much of a chess player, but it's such an interesting history.
Yeah, and it's such a, I think it's such a, it is such a transnational, trans-regional history as well.
Yeah.
Each with their own different varieties. So like when chess reaches China, it kind of gets blended with a game called Go, and the chess pieces move differently. Same two principles always sort of apply, that different pieces move differently, and that there's one piece that's sort of the key to everything. There's that applies in all sort of chess derived games. But in China, because Go is played with the pieces placed on the intersections of the squares, not on the squares themselves, that's how the chess-derived game was played when it arrived in China. So there's all these sort of lovely little histories. And yeah, what's his name? Ferdowsi, the Persian poet in the Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, tells this really delightful story about how chess was invented. And he says that there were two princes, Tav and Talhand, and they were in battle for the kingdom of Hind in India, and Talhand dies, and Gav has to go back and tell his mum, and his mum is distraught. And he swears that he never sort of injured him or anything. He just died in his saddle on his elephant. And so they bring out this 8x8 board, which is already used for a different game, and then put pieces on it and explain how Talhand died of exhaustion being chased around the board. And that's how the game of chess was invented, to try to explain to this distraught mum how somebody can die in battle on an elephant without actually being hurt by anybody. So there we go.
Interesting.
And
yeah,
then
Ferdowsi
also tells us that the Persians, when they played it, when you get to the point of defeating the king, they would shout shamat, which is where we get checkmate from, which means the king is helpless, which kind of rolls back to the story of Talhand. So, I've learned a lot about the origins of chess this week. It's been very interesting. And I now have newfound appreciation for my fridge magnet.
It is interesting. So one of the things I was wondering about, maybe the wrong thing, that as you were talking about this object, was how would they acquire the walrus ivory? Like, would they wrestle them, or they just kind of find it as they wash? Like, would it wash ashore?
Go out and wrestle walrus.
I mean, walrus wrestling has to be a thing.
It should be,
right?
Probably not. Probably,
I feel like it is.
I don't think Peter would like it very much.
Well, they don't really like anything.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it could be quite dangerous. Those they have tusks.
Yeah,
they're like, you know, elephants without legs, aren't they?
I mean, they can be aggressive, like walruses. And I feel like I've heard that.
There's actually this really disgusting story.
Yes,
disgusting story. An Anglo-Saxon story about how you make rope out of walrus, and you take a one live walrus, and you nail its tail down, and it tries to get away, and as it pulls away, it sort of skins itself and unravels the walrus rope.
Oh, that's horrible.
That you require. It is pretty horrible, isn't it? Yes, I'm not quite sure that is actually how you get walrus rope, but walrus hide was used for rigging. It's a very sort of strong thing. And like, as I said, these come from Greenland. You know, the Vikings did try to have a settlement on Greenland, which failed. But they probably would have had some dealings with the Inuit. And, you know, I'm sure they would find walrus. It could wash up. But I think they probably hunted the walrus or traded with the Greenlanders for it, I should imagine.
Yeah, that would make sense, I guess. Some kind of walrus, like, I don't know, harpooning or something, and then trading across the North Sea up around there. That's interesting.
Yeah, and you would get like four chess pieces from one walrus tusk. Certainly a... it certainly seems to have the same sort of carving properties as elephant ivory, probably be a little more accessible. And I wouldn't necessarily assume that it or whalebone was necessarily seen as an inferior product because they couldn't get elephant ivory. I think it would have been quite equatable.
Probably. And I also feel like elephant ivory would probably... have been either exorbitantly expensive or just in general, really difficult to come by, because by the time it would travel from Central and Southern and Western Asia, I mean, there's not much, like, the ivory is not much of the elephant, and it was heavily used in that region. So if it did make its way that far north and west, it probably would have been very expensive and very sparse, I would imagine. I don't really know.
Yeah, and some of the whale bones have the advantages of being flatter. There's only there's you know ivory has a big curve to it, and that's hard to work if you're trying to get something that's a flat like a plaque. So there might have been material advantages to using other things. And you know, for the size and prettiness of these things, you know, the walrus tusk would seem to be the perfect thing.
That's so interesting. And the color of it, I wonder, is walrus tusk naturally darker, or this is just aged?
I think this is aged. I think, it's. I really like the way that it's got a sheen to it still, but has you know the darker brown in areas. And actually, some of the pieces still have traces of pigment on them. And we have black and white pieces. They would have had white and red pieces, it seems.
That's interesting. Would they have used cochineal or
It's oh gosh, I
vegetable
can't
dye?
remember what it was. It was a pigment. I think it was a mineral pigment, like okra, or something like that, to make the reddy color.
Interesting. That's such a fascinating piece.
Yeah, and thanks for your story about soap. And we should. What should we name the? What something like the cleanliness of the chess women would be the name for our episode, maybe.
We'll have to think about it. Or just cleanliness and chess.
Cleanliness and chess, yes.
Every Armenian will click on it. That's like our favorite stuff.
All right, so let me just ask you before we wind up here. You've got stuff going on. What's the stuff in your life at the moment?
Stuff in my life is, for our listeners who may be aware, I just finished my PhD, so I'm working on my job application materials and applying for work and working with my lovely advisor to polish up those materials. And it's a process. It's giving me a lot of headaches, but it's moving along. So that's kind of taken up all of my time lately.
Yeah, that's cool.
And stuff in your life, you just had a birthday. That's
I just had
exciting.
a birthday. Yesterday was my birthday. It was very boring. I slept and I ate chocolate. And
Those two were great.
I've been doing a lot of work in my garden recently.
Oh.
So I'm growing grapes and kiwi and
Nice.
acacia. I haven't had any kiwi or acacia yet. I had a
I
few
was gonna
sort of
say.
I had a few grotty little grapes last year. I'm hoping for a little bit more this year. And I've got my tomatoes are flowering. I've got other things coming up, but it was a late start this year out in Michigan because it was cold and snowy and quite late into May, so I didn't get things until later. And I think it's more just the process of not doing anything in particular that I like about gardening rather than the results.
Well, it's interesting. It's the kind of thing, a friend of mine just had a baby and she remarked on how remarkably passive it was, the whole process. Like your body just does it for you. And I imagine
Well,
gardening is something like that.
it's sweaty and it's hard work. It's not sort of hanging around the garden in a floral silk dress and a
It's
large
not.
hat and a pair of sniffers, plucking off your perfect roses.
Oh,
Not
I
for
guess
me,
that's not
anyway.
for me.
I was putting in some new trenches to because we didn't have any vegetable garden, so. So that's what I've been doing recently. I have a
That's
sabbatical
exciting.
coming up, so I'm not feeling so pressured about work. So,
That's really exciting.
doing some me
Congratulations on
stuff.
that.
Yeah. Well, all right then. I'll say goodbye, Ashley.
Goodbye, Tracy.
And say goodbye to our listeners, too. Till
Bye,
next
listeners.
Time.
Bye. Thank you for joining us.